joining us. My name is Stephanie Lovinger, and I am the chair of SHOUT. On behalf of the students honoring outstanding university teaching, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you here tonight to present the 1999 Golden Apple Award. The concept of the Golden Apple Award began 9 years ago and was inspired by Rabbi Eliezer Ben Hyrcanus, who taught, Shuv Yom Echad Lifnei Mitatcha, get your life in order one day before you die. The Golden Apple Award honors those teachers who consistently treat every lecture as if it were their last and strive not only to disseminate knowledge, but to inspire and engage students in its pursuit. This year's winner is no exception. I have had the pleasure of being a student of hers last year. Dr. Brenda Gunnarsson was not only dedicated to this university, but to her students as well. Lecturing up until two days before she gave birth to her youngest child, she definitely showed how teaching is of great importance to her. I have been approached by many individuals telling me spectacular stories of how Dr. Gunnarsson has inspired them. One such student stated in her nomination of Dr. Gunnarsson, Brenda Gunnarsson is the best classroom teacher that I've had at Michigan. Her explanations are so lucid that throughout the term, various unlikely people told me that they really liked statistics. Before we hear Dr. Gunnarsson, I would now like to welcome the 1993 recipient of the Golden Apple Award, Professor Sydney Fine, to share with us a little about the award.
I was permitted to talk as long as I wanted to, but I was advised to be brief this evening, and I will be brief, difficult as that is for a professor, or at least for this professor. The Golden Apple Award that we're celebrating tonight is really a very special award, and the Golden Apple Ceremony is a very special event in the life of the University of Michigan. What is impressive about the award is not only that it celebrates teaching in so prominent a manner, but that is the consumers of the university's teaching, the students, who decide who the winner will be. The award is entirely in the hands of the students, and they have acquitted their responsibilities over the years in a thoroughly conscientious manner. What else can I say, having been a winner? I treasure all the awards that I have been fortunate enough to receive in a long career as a professor at the University of Michigan, but there is a special place in my heart for the Golden Apple Award, because it came from the students in my own classes who were expressing their more than generous reaction to the teaching to which I devoted so much part of my life as a professional historian. The Golden Apple Award, I am sure, has a very special place in the hearts of all the instructors who have received that award to date. Quite apart from the student role in determining the winner of the Golden Apple Award, the award ceremony itself is a very special event because it enables citizens of Ann Arbor, university administrators, university students, university faculty members to listen to a major lecture by a star teacher whom so many of us have never had the opportunity to hear before. I'm a historian, as you know, and I've often said that it is really easy to be a good history teacher because students bring a natural curiosity to the subject on which an instructor can capitalize. I'm perhaps betraying my own ignorance, but I do not think that most students come to a course in statistics with quite the same kind of curiosity as they come to the study of history. This is what makes the selection of Dr. Brenda Gunnarsson as this year's Golden Apple Award so very special. She is a splendid teacher whose receipt of the Golden Apple Award has been preceded by a string of LSNA teaching awards in the last several years. She has impressed her students not only with her knowledge and the importance of her subject, but she has also led them to enjoy the study of statistics. She has made her own enthusiasm for the subject infectious. I'm delighted to be able to join with you in listening to one of the university's great teachers deliver her ideal last lecture. Thank you.
We, the students honoring outstanding university teaching, would now like to invite Dr. Brenda Gunnarsson to the stage to receive her award and present her ideal last lecture, A Paradox of Penny in a Performance.
Thank you, everyone. First, I want to thank my students. You're the main reason I'm up here tonight. One of my favorite lines in the letter that I received back in January, stating that I was the recipient of this award, was as follows. Represented in this award are the students who have touched in the past, are currently inspiring, and will benefit in the future. Thank you, students. To my fellow faculty members and colleagues, I thank you for your support over these many years. To my family and my friends, I thank you for your love, your understanding, and your words of encouragement. And to my faith, my constant source of strength each and every day. Thank you, everyone. I might be at an elementary school function where I'll be meeting another mom or dad, some adult, and we'll introduce ourselves to each other. Hi, I'm Brenda Gunnarsson, Kyle's mom. Usually when you're at those functions, you're known as Kyle's mom or dad or something instead of your own name. And this is Kyle. You are, of course, going to see all of my children throughout the talk at some point in time because they are very dear to me. We might chit-chat a little bit about what's going on that evening, and then we'll come to the question, so what do? I teach at the University of Michigan. Oh, really? What do you teach? Statistics. That one word can send chills up and down the spine of many. Most people don't have fond memories of their experiences of taking a statistics course. In fact, some even respond by saying it was a course they were able to avoid, as if it were some type of plague. If you've been in my office, you may have seen this next picture. I have it up on my wall. That's my son Lee on the right, representing Stat 402, and my cousin Matthew on the left, representing Stat 100. It was a picture with all the stat quotations on a calendar that I had on my wall in my office. And a student came into my office once and said, "That's what I looked like when I knew I had to take a statistics course." The students get to evaluate the courses after the semester is passed, and they fill out an evaluation that goes from 1 to 5, with 1 representing strongly agree, disagree, and the 5 representing strongly agree. So the lower scores are for disagreement. And generally, the lowest score that I receive in those evaluations are for the following item number 4. I have a strong desire to take this course. In fact, 3 years ago, a student of mine sent me an email regarding a nightmare she had. And it goes like this. On Monday, the 19th of February, 1996, Carrie wrote, "Professor Gunnarsson, so last night I had this nightmare in which I was being chased by a man because I held the secret formula for late night talk show success. I ran to my parents' house and hid under the table and asked them, what should I do? They both had different opinions, and I became confused because their opinions came from different normal distributions, with mean being the opinion and variance being exceptions to the opinion. I didn't know which answer I should use to solve my problem, and I was becoming very flustered when my parents began chanting, standardize, standardize, standardize. True story," she writes, "I never actually found out what happened because I woke up, but I thought you might find this interesting. Statistics has pervaded my psyche. That's from Carrie, who graduated in 97. We still kept in touch, and recently she wrote me and said that when she was in high school, her algebra teacher told her she would never become a psychologist because psychologists need to do statistics, and she was not very good in math. Her A-plus in Stat 402 was a complete vindication of that awful comment. And she's now applying to graduate programs in clinical psychology. She lives in Los Angeles, works in the Substance Abuse Research Lab, and she says takes great pleasure in performing care sample T-tests. While we're on the subject of students, I'd like to share a few other little stories with you. First from Alice. Alice took my class at 402 in the summer, and she says, you made stats interesting and accessible and fun. Yes, that's the word fun in the same sentence as statistics. I know I'll need to use the skills I learned to analyze scientific research articles later. Thank you for not making me dread that. You have the ability to make complicated ideas very simple. Trying to make the complicated ideas simple. Stephen wrote, thank you for the letter regarding my performance in your class. If you get an A-plus in my class, you get a letter sent that says you did a commendable job. Please come in and talk to me and pick up your final. I gave you my mom's address, so that's where the letter was sent. I had no idea what grade I had in the course before the letter arrived. I called my mom's house one night, and she told me what mail I had and said I got a letter from the Department of Statistics. I got all worried because that was the last class I needed to graduate, and I was afraid something happened. So I told her to open it for me, and she read it and got all giddy and ran to Kinkle's and made about 10,000 copies. Thanks again for the letter. A person can only get an A-plus grade. And Carrie wrote to me and said, I just wanted to tell you that I know you care about us. You should be proud of the job you do here. Aside from your organization and preparation for the class, you add life to your teaching. We can tell you like stats, we still don't know why, and that makes all the difference. I do care about my students very much. And over the 10 years of teaching here, I've had the opportunity to teach over 8,000 students in my classes. And I still try, as a goal in my classes, to make the learning of statistics, make it interesting, make it applicable to your daily lives, to the fields that you're studying, and to sometimes, if possible, along the way, have a little fun. And what I want to do tonight is let you experience a little bit of that. I'm going to share with you a little bit about what I teach, a little bit about how I teach it, and through all that, we will see a paradox, a penny, and we'll end in a performance. All right. An important aspect of learning involves comparisons. We make comparisons in order to try to predict something that's going to happen in the future. We make comparisons by judging which of several options might be the better choice. Maybe we need to decide which of two drugs are going to be more likely to cure some disease. Or maybe choose between several alternative methods for teaching reading to elementary school children. What we're going to do is turn to some data tonight for making a decision between one of two drugs in the treatment of some disease. There were 2,200 subjects altogether. They received one of the two drugs, drug A or drug B, and we recorded the responses whether or not they improved or not after some period of treatment. There were 1,100 patients assigned to drug A, and of those, 600 improved. That would mean how many that didn't improve? 500. Good. 600 out of 1,100, or an improvement rate of 55%. 1,100 subjects also taking drug B, and of those, 900 improved. 200 did not. And an improvement right here, portion of patients improving here, would be the 82%. Well, there's the question. Based on those results, which drug appears to be better? Tell me. Drug B. Okay. Drug B appears to be the better drug, but you know that's not the end of the story. We need to look a little closer. And it turns out there was actually two hospitals behind this study. Two hospitals were used and we're going to look at the same results for those two hospitals. Now, first, verify if you read that. If you take these two sets of data here, these two tables, and put them back together, you're going to get the overall total, right? The 900 that improved on the drug 80 here and 510 gives us our 600 over there. So these two tables combined do give us the results in our aggregate. What about drug A? How do we do here? What proportion of patients improved on the drug A at hospital 1? What is it? 90 out of 100 or? What is the proportion for drug B at hospital 1? 86%. Which one seems to be the winner here? Drug A. How about over at hospital 2? 510 out of 1,000, so an improvement rate here of 51%. B has only 40%. The winner again, drug A. How can drug A be the winner at each hospital? You take that data and put it together, and overall we get that drug B is the winner. Seems to be a paradox. Closer look. Look at the rates for hospital 1 versus hospital 2. Which hospital would you want to be treated at if you had to be treated for this disease? So would you want to go to hospital 1 or hospital 2? 1. It has a higher rate of improvement overall. Although, now that might be because maybe the patients that were initially better, initial health status was better, were sent to hospital 1. Maybe those that were a little poorer status were sent to hospital 2. So maybe hospital 2 had the facilities to handle those kind of patients if something should go wrong. Drug A was a little bit better than B overall at each hospital. But what happened? Hospital 1 had initially the better patients. Which drug was primarily used at hospital 1? Drug B. Hospital 1 had the better patients, most of them used drug B. Hospital 2 had the generally worse patients, most of them used drug A. Can you see how combined the two will give you drug B being better overall? The initial health status here is a variable that's related to your response. How you are initially is going to determine how you're going to respond, whether you improve or not. And it's an important variable. The two hospitals were not the same. They were not alike with respect to that variable. And the combination gave a reversal. An example of Simpson's paradox, perils of aggregation. The reversal of results when several groups are combined together to form a single group. Now, some analyses fail to take into account these important variables. Sometimes these variables are not even known, or maybe not even measured. The example we went to now were some easy numbers. It was a contrived example. But there are some examples in real life, too, from which this occurs. The first one is an NSF study that was conducted on people who received a bachelor's degree in the science and engineering fields. Overall, women who had a full-time job earned an average salary that was 77% of the average male salary. But if you made a comparison of the salaries within each field, in the sciences. In each case, the average salary for women was at least 92% the average salary of males. What's the explanation in this example? Women are more concentrated in what areas of sciences? Social sciences, life sciences. Those sciences in general would have what kind of salaries compared to the others in science and engineering fields? The lower ones. Women were more concentrated in the fields that have the lower salaries to begin with. Another study was a survey that was conducted back in 1972, and then a follow-up survey was taking place 20 years later to look at the survival rates for smokers versus non-smokers. Overall, 76% of the smokers had survived, only 69% of the non-smokers. Seems to say that there's a beneficial effect of cigarette smoking. What variable is going to be strongly related to your survival? Is a young person going to be more likely to survive 20 years or an older person? A younger person. So age is an important variable here. And it turned out in the original survey, very few of the older women were smokers. But most of them had died by the time the follow-up came along. Mm-hmm. If you looked at the results on age groups, it turned out that smokers generally have the lower survival rate as compared to the non-smokers. So some examples that actually occurred. Another example that presents some interesting results. Diagnostic tests. cluster of minus response. We have some results about a test. It says that if you were to take this test and give it to a group of people that do have the disease, that 99% of them should test positively. If we were to take that test and go to a group of people that don't have the disease, 90% of them should test negative. And about 1% of the population don't have the disease. That's our initial estimate. Let's suppose that you have the test done, and the test comes back positive. Should you worry? What would be your chance that you actually have the disease? Now, I know some of you know the answer. I know some of you have seen the answer before, may have forgotten a couple years ago. What do you think? Do you think that your chance of having the disease if the test comes back positive should be at least 25%? Do you think it should be at least 25% chance if you have the disease, if the test positive? What do you think? Raise your hand. How many think it should be at least 25%? When I give this to my class initially, majority do. Raise your hand. When I give it to parents of prospective students, when I talk to them, most of those parents, raise your hand. At least 25%. The actual answer is about 9%. That means among those people that have a positive result, 91% of them don't have the disease. Seems kind of surprising. Well, we're going to verify this answer, and then we're going to discuss a little bit about why it is so surprising. To verify the answer, though, I need some help. I came in this room about 4 weeks ago, and I actually counted the chairs in this section right here. And there are about 100 chairs in this middle section. This is going to represent our population of 100 people. Now, according to our statement up here, about 1% of the population actually have the disease. So how many out of 100 people or 100 chairs would be a person with the disease? One. I need one person, please. I know this person. This is Laura. Laura has the disease, okay? It also says that if you take a group of people that have the disease, 99% should test positively. So there should be a 99% chance that she tests positively. So let's suppose the test does well and it does give her a positive result. So you have a positive test result. I want you to move here just a little bit further. Okay. Now, there's 99 people left here that don't have the disease. About 90% of them should test negative. That leaves what percent as positive? 10%. 10% of 99 is about 10. I need 10 more people. You want to come? All right. Doesn't hurt. Just come on up. Take your not disease sign and go stand a little closer to her over here. She's not contagious anymore. I need 10 people. Thank you. Thank you. We have a lot of volunteers for those that don't have the disease and those that do. Rate of how prevalent the disease is in the population to 10%. then your chance of having the disease goes up to over 50%, much more. So that's the riding factor here. What are the implications of this? The impact of getting a plus result back if you don't know the statistics. The impact of having mandatory drug testing in a company if the number of people suspected to be drug users is very small. The need for additional tests before you declare someone as having the disease or someone as being a drug user. Now, you all have an envelope, I hope, right? How many of you have already opened it to check and see what's inside? Some. You can go ahead and open it now. And I want you to take out a piece of paper and a pencil. Piece of paper and pencil. I'm going to have you do an activity here in just a moment. Very simple one. Is there anybody that's going to need one? There was a big box of them outside. They'll bring a few more in. Let me explain the activity while they're doing that. What I'm going to have you do in a moment is just write your name. I'm going to have you print your name, but don't do it yet, because we're all going to do it together. We're going to see how long it takes you to print your full name, first and last name. And you'll do that next to the number one on there. We're going to check and see how long that takes you. Very simple task. Anyone have any questions about what they're expecting to do? All right. Here come up with more envelopes. If you need one, please raise your hand. Just one envelope there. One of this. All right. To figure out how long it takes you, I will record the time as it goes by up front here. So in other words, once I give you the goal, you print your full name, first and last name, and as soon as you're done, you're going to look up and see how many seconds have passed. I'll be writing that up on an overhead up here. And write down the time next to the line that says time. All right. Everybody ready? Nope. Good. Three, two, one. Go. Is everybody done? Did you print your name? Did you follow the instructions? All right. My 6-year-old. All right. You got your time written down? I'm going to repeat that task again, but switch hands. Opposite hands. Opposite hands. And we'll give you the start. Ready, set, go. Thank you. And the theory is, on average, it takes a person 3 seconds longer to print their name with their opposite hand. How many of you would reject that theory? Reject. Okay. Is there anybody out here that actually did take 3 seconds or less? There are. Okay. It took 3 seconds or less. Did everyone get the same result, though? There was variation in the data. Lots of variation. Even with a few people having values around 3, even with the variation that we saw, we still, almost all of us, said we'd reject this theory. Example of the process we go through for making decisions. We have a theory in mind. We gather some observations, some data, and we take a look at that data in relationship to that theory to see whether that data seems consistent with that theory or is it unlikely, unusual under that theory. When it is surprising and unusual enough, we then reject that theory. The decision-making process. I do this activity on day 1 in one of my lectures. We talk about then the scientific method and the idea of how we make decisions and go through that cyclic process. We then go through the rest of the semester going through those areas of the scientific method in more detail throughout the course. You also have the penny in your envelope. Go ahead and take that out. Sometimes I have students learning about statistics with pennies. I have a big one up here. If I say that I have a fair coin and that I'm going to flip that coin, what's the chance of getting a heads? What would you say? Set one half. Right? We might talk a little bit then about probability, about how it's defined, and so forth. What if we took the penny and we stood it on the table, on edge? And you can actually do this. It works better when Lincoln's head is down. And then you hit the table hard enough to cause it to go one way or the other. Now what's the chance of getting heads? Is it going to be one half? We don't know for sure, do we? What do? We talk about the fact that that would be a random experiment with 2 outcomes, head or tail, but we don't know yet what's going to happen until you do it. We would repeat that experiment many times and look at the proportion heads in the long run that turn out of that experiment and use that as our estimate of that chance or probability. I want to share one more student story with you. She may actually be here tonight. She was in my class 5 years ago. Took my Stanford 402 class. And she said, I remember what a wonderful instructor you were and how patient you give you more of your time. Not only are you a talented professor, but a mentor for young women interested in pursuing math and science degrees. Your instruction motivated me to become a statistics major, the only female in my graduating class. Despite the numerous weird looks I get when I say I have a degree in statistics from U of M, I can confidently say that was the perfect choice for me. You can put your penny to good use tonight. When you leave the auditorium, there are some containers back there for collecting pennies. You can put your penny in that container. And it's going to represent a donation that's going to be made to establish an award for recognizing outstanding performance of undergraduate women majoring in statistics here at U of M. So put your penny in those containers. You also have one last item in your envelope, a piece of fabric. And that piece of fabric is going to help us answer the following question. We want to estimate a proportion, or proportion of those in the population that daily surf the net. 2 scenarios. The first scenario is when we have 500,000 adults in the population and we randomly select 1,000 of them. We'll use that information in that 1,000 to get our estimate of that proportion with daily surf the net. Scenario 2, 5 million adults, randomly select 1,000. From which of these 2 scenarios are we expected to get a better answer, a more precise answer? What do you think? How many say scenario 1? That's our tendency, because the population is smaller there than the other. It actually turns out that they're going to be the same. It's not going to depend on the size of the population, but the size of the sample, provided the population is much larger than the sample. And to help my students see that, I use fabric. Suppose I found some fabric and I want to take a piece of it home to show my husband so he can see what I picked out. Well, if I take a piece that's too small, he's not going to be able to see that pattern. Once I decide what size is big enough to show the pattern, it doesn't matter whether I take that from a small bolt of fabric or whether I take that size from a larger bolt of fabric. It's the size of the sample that matters. You've now seen some examples of what I teach and how I teach statistics. And some of the things that I try to do in my teaching, some of my models, are that I think that students don't really learn just by reading it. They don't necessarily learn just by having someone talk to them and teach it to them in a lecture format, but they learn most by thinking about it and doing it, and having that take place within the classroom as much as possible. That, of course, is going to involve interactions between the instructor and the students, and between the students themselves. When a student can explain an idea, like what the confidence level means, or what a standard error really means to another student, then they really have that idea down. And especially in statistics, when possible, try to not focus on the symbols, symbols less, but words more, to be able to explain what that formula is in English, and to see a common pattern in that formula to apply to other scenarios and techniques, is how the learning will take place. That, of course, requires organization, requires some preparation, and I think of a love for teaching. When I received a letter back in January about being a recipient of this award, well, that's back in January, they give you a lot of time to think about and prepare for this lecture. Sometimes a little bit too much, I think. Nonetheless, it's been a challenging task, and I've been very happy to see all your faces here tonight. At home, I have one of those flip calendars that give you a statement to read each day, and about a week after I received the letter about this award, there was a statement that sort of stuck with me, and I want to share that with you. It says, whether you know it or not, you are being watched. And the things you model, by design or by accident, powerfully communicate your convictions of right and wrong. If you want to pass on values to others, you must model those values in your own life. You must believe them yourself. I think that's quite a statement, that we are all models. As a teacher, we are models for our students. As a parent, you are models for your children. Help me to be honest, so my children will learn honesty. Help me to be kind, so my children will learn kindness. Help me to be faithful, so my children will learn faith. Help me to love, so my children will be loving. You're missing one child here tonight that you haven't seen yet. How many of you were in my class last winter term when I was out here? Well, meet the outcome of that process. This is Emily. 11 months old, and hopefully she'll be brought up here towards the end so she can be with all of us too. My two sons go to Eva White Elementary School. And at that school, over the last couple of years, they've been focusing on learning about life skills and following lifelong guidelines. The life skills that they've been talking about over the past couple months have been cooperation, caring, and effort. And they have activities and school assemblies that focus on these skills. They learn and they follow lifelong guidelines that they call Eva White Pride. No put-downs. Respect and trust one another. Insist on your personal best. Discuss and listen actively. Give truth and honesty and expect that back in return. I think these guidelines and skills can and should be reinforced and followed at all stages of our lives. You are probably asking one more question. What about those jars? Right. Well, I want you to think of these jars as students. Or maybe as your children. Maybe your fellow employees, those that you work with. And this jar here if you demonstrate honesty, truthfulness, then you will in turn help your children, your students, discover and develop their own gifts, unique to each individual, yet together gives us our very colorful and wonderful world that we live in. Being a teacher, I'm able to enrich the lives of my students so that they can in turn discover their own gifts and put them to good use. We have all been given gifts. I've been blessed with the gift of teaching. As a mom and as a Sunday school teacher, I work with younger children, and sometimes to communicate ideas to those children, we have to use other media, songs, skits, and so forth. I decided to end my last lecture with a song. And to show you the extent of my musical background, yes, that's me in grade school taking piano lessons, playing the guitar. I actually took ukulele lessons back in third grade from my third grade teacher. And my mom was actually taking guitar lessons, and I kind of just picked it up after that, so no formal lessons there. As far as the singing goes, I was never in the St. Olaf Choir, okay? But I still want to share something with you today.
Thank you and have a wonderful evening.